Good afternoon. I will now call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is exactly 1:30 p.m. on Thursday, March 16th, 2023. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business today. Present today is Vice Chair Wilson and Senator Rob Myers and myself, James Kaufman. Senator Keel and Tobin may be along later, and we'll note their presence when they show up. So staffing the committee today is LIO Moderator Lisa Denny, and as always, or as often, Johanna Crossett from Records is keeping the notes. My Transportation Committee aide, Emma Torkelson. Thank you, Emma, for all the work you do every day that we have these meetings. Before we pull out of the station, please silence your cell phones or place them on the tracks if you don't want to hear from them anymore. So today we'll be hearing a presentation from the Alaska Railroad Corporation. And as always, we'll be focusing on not just what the railroad is doing, but what they're doing to get better every day as they manage their operations. So presenting today is Mr. Bill O'Leary, President and CEO of Alaska Railroad Corporation. And we also have a number of folks on Teams today that we'll have, I think, introduce themselves as we get to that point. Mr. O'Leary, please approach the bench and introduce yourself for the record. And as we proceed, please feel free to access your team as needed.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Railroad, and as the chair noted, we do have a number of members of the railroad senior management team available if there are questions that elude me at this point. So we've got the team here today. Very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and very much appreciate the guidance given to the railroad by the chair about what the committee is most interested in. It gave us, I think, an opportunity to really think through our presentation and sort of change it around a little bit from the standard overview that we have historically done, because I think there are, and really highlight some different aspects of your state-owned railroad and who we are and really where we're going. And to that end, we've kind of broken the presentation into sort of two categories here, just a little bit of a background here that we'll spend just a few minutes on, but then really focus more on the challenges that we face and how we have moved to meet those challenges and move ahead from them here. This, you know, really is a pretty full presentation, so I'm planning on moving relatively quickly throughout. I'm sure the committee will ask questions if I'm moving over something too rapidly here.
Appreciate that. I just want to note for the record that Senator Keel managed to jump on board at 1:31 p.m. Thank you.
Appreciate the whistle stop, Mr. Chair.
It really does write itself, doesn't it, almost?
We're sorry. So please proceed. Please proceed. Lots of material here to go through.
Lots of material to go through. Before we get really into the main heart of the presentation, though, I will say you'll never really see an Alaska Railroad presentation without a safety slide in it. It's a core value of ours. It's something we take extraordinarily seriously here. And really, the takeaways from this, the slides or the pictures on the left side of that of the slide are actual social media pictures that we have found in Alaska for folks actually on the tracks and doing things that we consider to be very, very dangerous. And you know, it's something we realize that you know, we are impactful in many ways throughout the state, but safety is a primary concern. We ask people to, if you do need to cross the railroad, you do it quickly and you don't do it longitudinally, but you just get across there. That's something that, again, is very important to us. That picture on the right is a picture of an issue we had a few weeks back where one of our northbound freight trains coming from Whittier came around the corner very late at night and into an avalanche that had come down. And all that is just a, could have been far worse than it was, is just a stark reminder that while we live in a very beautiful place, we also live in a very dangerous environment going forward. So First part, who we are, what we do. I am going to spend a little more time on this slide than I will on many of the others here, and it's kind of our quick facts, we call it. But this really talks a little bit about the railroad itself. The railroad was formed, or actually, you know, purchased by the state of Alaska from the federal government in 1985. The railroad itself was completed in 1923, and hold that thought, we'll be coming back to it towards the very end here. But the state purchased the railroad from the federal government in 1985 and set it up as a state-owned corporation, but a state-owned corporation very different than any other state-owned corporation for the most part. It's an independent corporation that has a separate and distinct, from state government, charged with being self-sustaining. And we take that, we'll talk more about that in a bit here, but meaning that we need to make a profit every year to be able to maintain the massive infrastructure that we have. For many, in many, many aspects, we look, smell, taste, and feel like private enterprise, but we are definitely a governmentally owned entity. We have a mission that is, as you'll see momentarily, that is, you know, very much focused on service to Alaska and to economic development of this state. Be very clear, there are no ongoing or general funds that are used to support the railroad. It is, again, self-sustaining through our revenues that we earn and the federal monies that we are eligible for as a year-round passenger provider. We are not state employees, but we are actually corporate employees, so a very different, separate and unique pay and benefit systems. And our debts are our own. They are not, by statute, they are not debts of the state of Alaska. And again, we aim to earn a profit to remain self-sustaining and not have to go come to the state asking for subsidy or general fund monies. So we take those profits and we plow them right back into the infrastructure. And as you see on there, you know, it's a 600 plus miles of track all in, pushing 1,000, especially if you include vehicles and equipment. We have over 1,000 pieces of on rail and rolling stock. Equipment out there. It's a significant infrastructure to have to maintain and have to maintain and keep it in a state of good repair to keep it safe for and allow us to really meet our mission here.
Thank you. I'd just like to know for the record, Senator Tobin joins us at 1:36 p.m.
Many of the powers of the Alaska Railroad are vested in our 7-person board of directors that are appointed by the governor, include 2 members of the governor's cabinet. And we do have significant ties to the state, as evidenced by the fact we're here today, certainly, for certain things that we need authorization from the legislature for, and we certainly provide a number of different reports and updates on a regular basis. Really, we're 600 employees year-round. We swell up to, give or take, 750 or more during the summer months, during our major construction season and busy season, as we call it. 5 unions on property, give or take 2/3 of our employees are members of the unions. So with that as sort of the lead-in as to who we are, really want to talk a little bit more about the challenges that we face. But before we do that, talk just a little bit about sort of how we approach this. And it really is sort of a hierarchical approach that is driven initially from our enabling statute, which lays out very clearly what the railroad is and is not and what it is to do. And from that, we have a mission statement, and you see that written on the slide there. It's relatively lengthy, but it can really be boiled down to 3 words, and that's safety, service, and profitability. And that's the primary takeaway from that mission statement. That mission statement drives what we do. It's as simple as that. And then beneath that, we have a series, again, sort of a hierarchy of ways that we, break that down so that really at the end of the day, in a perfect world, every employee knows what their role is and how it supports the mission statement and, effectively our enabling statute. So, right below the mission statement in that hierarchy is our strategic plan that we have usually 5-year time frame on those. With the, this one is coming due at the end of this year, 2023. And, you know, in that, we've identified, as the next slide will show, really, you know, five high-level strategic initiatives that that we focus on. And from that strategic plan, again, board is, our board of directors is very much involved in the development of that plan, approves it at the end of it. We create annual strategic goals for the corporation. Again, all of them rolling up under those one or more of those five strategic initiatives. And that becomes the basis then for the departmental goals that we create, and then down to the individual manager's goals. So, you know, again, a terrific structure if it works, and it does work for the most part. And so it's something that we're proud of. And it,
thank you. Please, for a moment, we have a question from Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at the mission statement here, and it says provide safe, efficient, economic transportation, makes total sense, and real estate services. My question is, why real estate? Statute identifies operation of the railroad as essential government function, not real estate as an essential government function.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, so we look at real estate. Real estate is really a core function of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. And it's something, I mean, we certainly provide, you know, freight and passenger services, but we also provide real estate services by virtue of the fact that we are the stewards of 36,000 acres of land. And so it is something that we felt was important that, you know, should be included in the in our mission, that it's not something that is sort of, you know, is secondary to the actual direct transportation services we provide, but is a core component of the Alaska Railroad.
All done for now.
All right, let's proceed.
Okay. So just very briefly on the strategic plan, you see the five strategic initiatives in front of you there, and they really are, you know, focused on the long-term items 1 and 2 are focused really on the long-term viability of the Alaska Railroad and how it can remain a going concern, how it can be self-sustaining going forward. Item 3, talking about the, you know, a real key for us, and that is investment back into the railroad to make sure that it can continue to be, you know, the strong force that it is. And then item 4, discussing safety, and in the new strategic plan that we're working on as we speak here, that will actually move up to 1. We treat all of these as very much equal, but I think in deference to the fact that safety is a absolute core piece of our culture, it that will be moving up to the 1 slot. And then the 5th item, which is that relates to us, as we'll talk about later on here, you know, effectively being a good neighbor and working with many of the various stakeholders that we have in the state, whether it's the legislature, whether it's customers, whether it's neighbors or local governments out there. But each one of these then has, as you see, hopefully in your packet, you received a copy of the strategic plan, the detailed plan that actually has, you know, sub-goals underneath there. When we get to the end of 2023, we will be measuring how we did on those sub-goals. We do measure it, you know, each year against our departmental or against our corporate goals. But it will be interesting in through the development of the next iteration of our strategic plan. So really the next steps we wanted to go through were kind of a little bit of detail on some of the challenges that relate and kind of organize it under those five components of the strategic plan. So items 1 and 2 really relate to our financial well-being and how well, how are we doing against that. As I mentioned, we in many ways look, smell, taste, and feel like private enterprise, and like private enterprise, we keep our books very similar to that. So we measure net income. We are a calendar year operation, so we are right now in the final throes of putting together our annual report and getting our external auditor to you know, finish looking at the books. So the 2022 numbers are not finalized. We do have unaudited numbers out there. But you see on the graph on the left is a measure of our really about the last 11 years of our net income. And Each year, as you can well imagine, has a story attached to it. I will say that, you know, we have enjoyed strength of late coming out of the pandemic here, as you'll see in the next couple of slides when we start talking about a bit more detailed on some of our business lines here. And we are looking at an unaudited net income of just shy of $40 million in 2022. Definitely a couple of one-off type items in there in 2022 related to some accounting, the way accounting for some of the federal monies we received through the CARES Act and ARP monies out there. But turn your attention to the graph or the not really, it's kind of a donut graph, a life preserver graph on the right. There are unaudited 2022 sources of revenue. And you see that our freight revenues are our largest component of our key revenue streams. But, followed by passenger, again, which we're probably very well known for, and our real estate activities. We do have grant revenues in there. And again, we as a year-round provider of scheduled passenger transportation are eligible for federal monies. So we receive formula monies through the federal U.S. Department of Transportation, Federal Transit Administration. And the vast majority of those monies go towards capital projects. There are some of those monies that are eligible to reimburse us for operating expenses in there. But the amount of grant revenue that we recognize through the accounting process is shown there at $67 million, and again, a little bit higher this year than one would think it would normally be. So breaking it down slightly into our...
We have a question. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. So, Larry, we talked a little bit about some of the federal funds coming in, and we talked a little bit about this, about IJA funds. What's the possibility of the railroad applying for? Have they applied for? And are there any plans to look at additional federal funds to help our Alaska railroad system?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, we are actively pursuing a number of different competitive grants. I mean, we are, by way of a little bit of background, so we receive the monies from the Federal Transit Administration that I discussed on a formula basis. So those come in every year based upon the number of passengers over route miles and things of that nature. But as a public transportation provider, we are also eligible for competitive grants out there, but that are just that. You have to go compete for them. And we have actually we've historically been successful in that particular realm, and we are actually upsizing our grants group at this particular point, which is tough space to be operating in because it's a very competitive field to get good grants people these days to make ourselves more competitive. I think right now we have we're planning on applying for either two or three of those competitive grants within the next 6 weeks to 2 months. And we'll continue to look for opportunities for that.
Follow up. And a lot of communities are working with various stakeholders to try to beef up the sort of a more collaborative approach for their grant writings. You know, I know that AML has been working. Have you worked with any of the other local municipalities that may also benefit from expansion of rail service or any other agencies or groups, just some partnership or collaborations in terms of having a stronger application process so we don't have to compete for the same grant writers?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, we have. Matter of fact, two examples come to mind right away. It's probably might be a year or two ago that might be a little longer than that even, that we combined with Fairbanks North Star Borough and the MAPSU Borough to, and I believe one of the utilities out of Fairbanks in grant application to extend the do a large part of the rail alignment down to Port McKenzie and we were not successful in that endeavor, but it was a good opportunity for us to work together on that, and we look forward to doing more of that to hopefully bring that project to fruition. We actually just about an hour and a half ago I signed a joint application with the municipality of Anchorage for a project down at the Port of Alaska to a project that we've been working on with them for about the last decade or so that would kind of shift some of our intermodal facilities to the port from our yard at this point. So we like collaboration. We think it's a good thing because you're right. It's tight space out there for getting grant writers.
Thank you. All right, thank you. Let's proceed.
Okay, to passenger operations. Definitely what we're best known for here. This is our passenger count over the last 10 years or so. And you see it's broken into two, the blue and the gold, not coincidentally our colors at this point, but with the gold being the riders or the passengers that are in cars not owned by the Alaska Railroad, but that are pulled on our tracks by our locomotives, and the blue being guests that are in Alaska Railroad coaches. And obviously you see the impacts of the pandemic in 20 and 21 there. Very strong recovery in 22. 2022, Alaska was the place to be for visitors at this point. A little lighter on the cruise side as they got off to a little bit of a slower start coming across the Gulf of Alaska. But strong recovery in 22, and we're expecting even stronger results in 23. Won't spend a whole lot of time on this particular slide other than it just talks a little bit about we still have big plans for our passenger service. We think it's a great service. We think it's something we're continually working to improve the service on and to look at actually increasing service if possible. But it's a relatively formidable task to do that just given costs and things of that nature. But it's important for us. Freight operations, and I would often show this graph and characterize it as one of the sadder graphs you're ever going to see, as it really does show on a tonnage basis a significant decline in activity on the railroad over the past 10 years. And if you were to actually take that graph back to more the 2003-2004 time frame, you would see that decline is even more pronounced, especially as the refinery in Fairbanks, or outside of Fairbanks, the Flint Hills refinery, was our largest freight customer for a number of years, and they were stepping down. That bulk petroleum line would have been significantly higher back in the 03, 04, 05 time frame. You do take a look impactful the pandemic's impact on even the freight side in 20 and 21. I'm pleased to note, our tonnage for 22 took a noticeable upswing, and we had a strong, compared to the last couple of years anyway, gravel season for us, and also that red dial of other, or that red portion of the stacked bar graph with other, reflective of some of the activity down at our Seward freight dock, as we were significant amounts of frac sand and other commodities coming into the state were hauled. Again, we are expecting another positive year on the freight side as things continue to develop on the North Slope. It's amazing, even though we don't go to the North Slope, terminating in Fairbanks, it's amazing how much we actually, and the Alaska Railroad supports that activity. Just some highlights about what may be out there. Now, we're up 42% on our revenue side year over year. Now, granted, that was off of a relatively depressed base in 2021. There are still opportunities, we believe, for liquefied natural gas by rail. In 2016, we were the first railroad in the country to receive approval from our regulator to be able to move LNG by rail in ISO containers. We did a demonstration project for about a month with a number of extraordinarily nervous regulators watching every single move, and it was very successful. The market has not caught up with that at this particular point, and that is still not, hasn't been, we're not moving LNG commercially at this particular point.
One moment, we have a question. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, My question about the LNG is kind of how, because the narrative going around this building right now is about the impending shortage of LNG in the Anchorage area, and very soon they won't have any LNG to ship up to Fairbanks. And so I'm I'm wondering why the railroad sees that as a growth potential.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, it's something I think there's still. I mean, we're aware of the recent developments on the North Slope and the putting a processing plant in up there, and I think that certainly could be impactful to this opportunity at this point. But I think there still are a number of groups out there that are looking that they think moving a northbound move of LNG for whether from whether from Alaska or from another source could be something that could work out also for there. So again, we just want to be ready and available if that opportunity presents itself to assist. I mean, the interior with getting lower cost and environmentally friendly fuel source. Interline barge service is something again. It's a something we're quite proud of. It's actually a service. It does connect us to the lower 48 railroads, and we have a partnership we have with one of the Linden companies, Alaska Marine Lines, and there are a number of rail barges, so actual barges with railroad tracks on them, 8 tracks on them each. And so what this basically means is somebody can order a load of pipe, as an example, in Texas. It can be rolled in Texas. It can roll up the railed up the coast to our dock in Seattle, where it then rolls onto the barge, sails to Whittier, comes off and rolls directly onto our system, taken up to Fairbanks for transload onto trucks up to the North Slope. Tremendously efficient, tremendously cost-effective way of moving heavy, bulky products or things that need to move in bulk. So we think with, again, sort of the renaissance on the North Slope to some degree, this is something that we actually are looking at our capacity issues out there, capacity constraints out there going forward.
Thank you. We have a question. Senator Wilson.
For those cars that come up, are they reused or do we just ship them back or how do we verify them for safety? Because I know most containers, they're just a one-way destination. So how do we do that with these cars?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. So that's always been the issue with Alaska, the backhaul, right? And it's to the extent if there is backhaul available, we will certainly try to coordinate those kind of things, but oftentimes they do go back empty. That is it's true.
So follow up. We don't keep them. They head on back empty. And is it the shipper that pays for that or how?
Yeah, through the chairs, Senator Wilson. So right, they're not Alaska Railroad owned cars. They're cars owned by usually other railroads or the shipper, as you say. And so, they will come onto the railroad's barge, come up, we'll, get them to their destination, unload them, and then bring them back. I mean, we do safety inspections along the way to, ensure that they're going through. That, again, we have there's no issues out there.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's proceed.
And the third leg of our the financial puzzle relates to our real estate revenues here. And this is, again, we're going to talk some more about some of our corridor here in a little bit. But as you can see, the vast majority of our real estate revenues are driven by our leases and our permits. Again, about 36,000 acres of land, much of that used in actual railroad operations. A significant portion of it, however, available for use by other governmental entities, private sector, others in general here. And we like leasing land. We think that's something that is a marvelous part of the Alaska Railroad model. And it's a key piece of our financial puzzle in that it really balances out the vagaries of the business cycles related to freight and passenger. I mean, those can be very cyclical about different things. Real estate is a very consistent source of income for the railroad. We try if possible to those lands to be used for economic development type purposes. We think it's marvelous. Not surprisingly, most of our lands are located close or right beside rail activities. So to be able to use a rail customer and provide them with area for whatever they want to use land for is really, I think, extra beneficial. Again, what's next?
We have a question, Senator Tobin.
Thank you so much. And I'm just curious to hear you expand a little bit. I know that one of the big projects that was conducted with the railroad in downtown Anchorage was the Downtown Edge, the housing development. And I'm very curious to know more about this particular practice and if you are intending to do more to help us build housing stock and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, the Downtown Edge is something we're quite proud of, actually. It was some of the first new housing developed in Anchorage, in downtown Anchorage, in a number of years, and it was done on leased railroad property. And that was, you know, kind of a first to a large degree, because a number of the developers, you know, it's commonplace in other states, but have not done significant developments on leased land before. So it took kind of an education effort, both for the financial institutions and the developers out there, to make this project successful. But it is successful. I believe there's five phases to it. I believe we're either on the third or fourth phase is being constructed as we speak right now. And to the best of my knowledge, they're selling. They're selling very well at this particular point. And it's something we would like to do more of, because we do have some great land holdings for that in the area. But again, it's not the kind of thing that where the Alaska Railroad is going to go out and do that development necessarily. We're going to make the land available. We're going to work with the developers to try to make it as successful as we possibly can.
Let's proceed.
All right. So the third item on the strategic plan relates to our capital investments. And really, if a lot of people look at our net income as a, how's the railroad doing? And that's a very important metric, there's no doubt. I would say that a better metric, however, if you had to boil it down to one, I wouldn't just boil it down to one, but if you had to, would be the amount that we are able to invest back into the infrastructure. And I think through our capital program, quite honestly. And, you know, I mean, it's all related, because, I mean, the more cash that we are able to generate to be able to put into our infrastructure, the better. But there's also other sources that we use, both on the federal side and sometimes debt, to have a robust capital program, which is really an excellent measure of whether we are maintaining this very valuable asset. So this is just an overview of how we go about selecting what capital program or what capital projects we do, because not surprisingly, as those of you on Finance Committee are well aware, or any of you are well aware, it's, wants and desires exceed available resources in many cases. So we had the railroad-wide over $220 million worth of projects identified for 2023 alone that were important, and we go through a very robust process to whittle that down. And the criteria we use, really, it's not shown on the slide, but it really is, again, driven by the strategic plan and our mission statement out there. And so part of it is, yes, we want to have something that's going to provide us with a return on investment, if at all possible. But we have to, there's capital maintenance also that doesn't, it's more difficult to measure exactly what that specific ROI is on there. And then there are projects that are really more economic development type projects that will be good for the state as a whole, or good for railroad employees as a whole. I mean, things of that nature. I mean, one of the things we've been working on is just section housing for our people that work out in the, along the rail line, away from the larger communities out there. And difficult to immediately put a regularly calculable ROI on something like that, but it's something that is, important to having a committed workforce. So this is just really an overview of it. Really, this slide is a high-level view by fund source of our five-year program. We prepare a five-year program. You should actually, one of the handouts we provided was our required report to the state, where we provide you with that very detailed five-year capital plan every year. This is just sort of a summary of that. And really, the bottom right-hand corner, we are looking over the next 5 years to put $500 million into the railroad. And in addition to that is outside of some of the Seward investments that we're going to be talking about a little bit later on here, because those are fall outside. Well, I mean, they still go through the same process, but in some cases they've already been approved, or they'll be or to be approved coming up here. But it's a tremendous amount of money by any stretch of the imagination, and it's going to allow us to really address the continuing maintenance backlog that is out there. I mean, this railroad came over from federal ownership in, I would characterize it, in very poor shape. The organization has done an amazing job over the past, decades of trying to bring that up, making it a much safer, much more efficient railroad by almost every measure. But there's a lot to do, and there's still a lot to do, even with this amount of funds in there. One of my predecessors made the great line, "You are only as good as the next bridge here," and that's absolutely true. We've got 175 of those, got a major bridge program over the next 5 to 10 years, and we're going to be putting a lot of money into that. Obviously, track is bread and butter stuff for us, and it's a significant portion of our program every year.
While we're on bridges, could we just had a hearing about the increased functionality of drones as used for inspection, enabling much more comprehensive mapping of the underside of structures, bridges particularly. Are you adopting that technology? And perhaps working with anyone in state to do that?
Chair Kaufman, we are working. We actually have a drone program. I wouldn't call it necessarily in its infancy. It's developed a little bit past that stage, but I don't think we fully unlocked all of the benefits that we're going to get out of it. But exactly for what you're talking about, the ability to inspect places and things that are in otherwise dangerous or difficult to areas to reach, I think we've also seen a lot of benefit with unmanned aerial vehicles for emergency situations, being able to fly over. I mean, when in cases of avalanches and, checking out what exactly we're dealing with here. So we do have that program going, but it's not something that I'd say it's at full build out yet.
I just say we can get together after the committee hearing today and just maybe help you make the connection with
Great.
The folks that gave that presentation. I think they might be able to help accelerate what you're doing.
Great. Very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, we have a question. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. I should have two questions. First, sort of dab a little bit about employment. How's the railroad doing in terms of their workforce after COVID? Has you guys all 100% all back and fully going, or?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. So it's a tough space out there right now. There is no doubt about that for us. We made the decision when COVID hit, and you saw the impacts on our business lines, that our goal was to not hack the organization to bits to try to address that situation. We did impact seasonal hires relatively significantly because, again, especially on the passenger side, we were not running very many passenger trains during that time frame. But we did not reduce our full-time headcount. And I think that has paid off greatly for us at this point, in that we didn't lose a bunch of people or send a bunch of people packing and then come back and try to find them again. I will tell you that we do find it difficult at this point for not only seasonal staff but actual new hires on a number of different positions out there, which I don't think is different than many other entities in the state or actually even nationwide out there. It's much tougher space for us to operate in. So we're doing some different things about that. We've gone from everywhere from hiring type bonuses for seasonals to if you make it through, part at the beginning, part at the end of the season. We have a referral program in place now, employee referral program. So, just trying some things that have not been done in the past to really attract folks in.
One more question. Follow up.
Also in the workforce, autonomous trains. Are you guys anywhere near sort of AI sort of, or pilot projects running autonomous trains?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, no.
Well, and only ask because we've seen autonomous caravans flying, you know, the cars. And so there's been a lot of movement, and I know a lot of folks like sort of rural destinations to try those programs out. So I just didn't know if Alaska has been approached by any folks out there just because of some of our remoteness and less populated areas to operate.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson. Yeah, it's there certainly is a lot of interest, especially in the lower 48, about you know, working with that. We do not necessarily believe that, given the unique situation that we have in Alaska, that something like that would be effective at this particular point.
Some of those I've seen are more focused on light rail with kind of a semi-monitored approach. We have a question from Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to piggyback on Senator Wilson's workforce questions, you mentioned in an earlier slide that you're completely separate from the state in terms of your employment contracts and things like that. What's the status of your retirement plans? Is it defined benefit, defined contribution? Where's that?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, yes, we have a defined benefit plan in place. We have two tiers on that. We had one that was put in place at transfer from the federal government, and then we put a second tier in place, I believe, in the 2010 time frame. It is still a DB plan. It is just a different DB plan with some modifications to the benefits out there. We do offer, we don't have anything like the, you know, SBS or anything like that. We are not in Social Security. We do offer a 401k program also with matching funds depending on various collective bargaining agreements.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
Okay. So continuing on our capital investment side of things, I want to talk about a couple of different areas that we're focusing on. And one of those is in Whittier at this point. And Whittier is a you know, key area for the Alaska Railroad in that it is the landing spot of our of the barge program, and it is something that you know, we are putting a lot of effort into master planning, because we do think that Whittier is going to grow for us, and so we have a you know, $1 million project at this point, funded primarily by a federal grant, to actually update our master plan. Point. It's a 15-year-old plan at this point. We like to work off of master plans, but we take those and really actually use them as a guide, as a blueprint for continued investment going forward. So that's something that is will be ongoing starting this summer that we're excited about. And then we get to Seward. And Seward is really, I characterize Seward as a key asset for the Alaska Railroad. And this slide, we've got a number of slides on Seward here. I'm going to go through them kind of quickly. This one is just the best one because it has a map in it here. We have three docks in Seward, and you start seeing up at the top of that picture our freight dock, then we have our passenger dock, and then a coal dock, which coal dock has not been used really for that purpose since the 2016 timeframe. We did have a master planning process that we went through for Seward, and we are working off of that at this particular point. So we have two major projects to give a quick overview on. The first one is related to our freight dock, and that is a $25 million or more investment that we'll be making. Again, significant dollars funded by a federal grant to widen and lengthen that dock. This one has kind of fallen a little bit behind the passenger dock. And the passenger dock is something that we are looking to accomplish first, and then immediately or relatively soon follow up with the freight dock. The passenger dock here is a $150 million investment that we're going to talk about here actually in the next slide. So out of the three docks in Seward, the passenger dock is the one that was it was built probably around 1960, or it was built in 1966, and has entered what we would kind of characterize it as hospice care at this point. It is still very much safe to use and operate, but end of life is near. And as a result, We've gone through a number of different iterations on this project to replace this and have finally settled on a more conventional approach on this, where the railroad would design, build, own and operate a new dock that will be a new dock and a new terminal facility. The reason this dock is critical is it's a passenger dock. It's used by the cruise industry at this point, and give or take, somewhere between one half to two thirds of the cruise passengers that come that will take cruises across the Gulf of Alaska and come to South Central Alaska will land at this particular dock, and it really functions as a gateway to not only the Kenai Peninsula but to Anchorage and then up into the interior to Talkeetna, Denali, and Fairbanks for the visitor industry, for cruise passengers. So it's a critical asset for the visitor industry and just the South Central visitor industry, the interior visitor industry. So we have been working closely with a very good customer of ours, 20-year-plus customer of ours, the Royal Caribbean Group, and they're going to act as the anchor tenant on this particular project and will effectively underwrite the cost of this particular project. So it is, at this particular point, we're still hammering down the last pieces of the deal with our contractors and everything else, but is roughly $150 million project for investment into Seward, which we think is going to be a tremendous benefit to not only that community, but also to the entire visitor industry out there. So to do that, we have currently two items that immediately come out that we need legislative approval for, that are things that are not vested in our powers, that are not vested in our board of directors are. The first was if we were to divest ourselves, sell or transfer land, which doesn't apply here. But the second one is if we are to issue public debt, if we are to go to the bond market, we need legislative approval for that. And so we are going to be asking for that legislative approval to give us up to $150 million, or the ability to issue up to $150 million worth of debt. This would be tax-exempt governmental bonds, which are far and away the most efficient, cost-effective form of debt, and can really bring this project in at in a very cost-effective manner. The good news about this debt, from certainly the state or the legislature's perspective, is by statute, debt of the Alaska Railroad is not debt of the state and cannot be debt of the state. So it is something that would reside on our balance sheet, but again, it would be secured by a long-term berthing agreement with Royal Caribbean Group that would effectively pay for this this debt and pay for service the debt going forward here. So that's foreshadowing, one of my favorite literary techniques here, coming soon to a transportation committee near you here. We're very excited about this project. The second project is the freight dock expansion. We'll be following on the passenger dock expansion and passenger dock replacement. And you see some of the stats there. One of the real benefits of this particular dock is there's also very significant uplands available, which, again, makes it very attractive. It's gotten a lot of use over the last couple of years. Again, as I've mentioned, frac sand, pipe ships, things of that nature coming in and using this particular dock. Shifting gears a little bit, but still staying on the capital side, we were asked to speak a little bit about how we view rail extensions and rail realignments. And the slide kind of speaks for itself to a large degree, but it's we are generally almost exclusively in support of such things. We think infrastructure is a good thing in Alaska. It needs to be smart infrastructure. It needs to be infrastructure that is, well thought through and designed appropriately. And from the Alaska Railroad's perspective, again, since we are not looking for subsidies you know, from the general fund out there. It has to be, you know, we look at these rail alignments or rail extensions as external funding sources would have to be brought to bear to complete them. But in, and then we would expect to be able to generate enough revenue off of the use of those to at least pay for our O&M and a, you know, slight return. I mean, again, it all falls back into that model of the Alaska Railroad where we have to be self-sustaining. So we can't operate at a loss, or certainly can't do that for very long.
Excuse me, Senator Myers has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's been a talk of a rail realignment project in the Fairbanks area for 20-odd years, at least I'm aware of, maybe longer, pull the rail out of Fort Wainwright, Badger Road, and portions of North Pole area. It's my understanding, though, that that project got dropped. The general theory was realign the rail along the southern end of town and along the southern side of the Richardson Highway out to North Pole. But then that project got dropped around 2010 or so, give or take. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I can just give you my recollection. We certainly have a couple people on the line that could give a little more history on that, but I believe the funding on that, there was not sufficient funding. There was some funding identified through old, I believe, some old Ted Stevens earmark monies for that, from perhaps the Wainwright portion of that. But there was not certainly funding to do all of that. The rail realignment in general, there's been a lot of talk in Fairbanks for, you're correct, decades about whether the idea of even, you know, getting the rail yard out of downtown Fairbanks altogether and then moving that, kind of getting it all the way outside of the community itself. But it's a massive project that, again, no funding has been identified for.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, my understanding of it is that not moving the entire rail yard. I understand how big of an issue that would be, but just realigning portions of the track so that a train that was going to go to North Pole could kind of go west first and then south and then down. My understanding was that part of the reason that that project got dropped was not so much the financing, but it was because the legislature passed a bill saying that if the railroad moved, that they would have to give up the land that the current track is under. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I don't know the answer to that. I will ask one question to our group on the online if they are aware of that. If not, we can research that and get back to you. Is that that's acceptable?
Yes, it is. If I may, just a reminder for those on Teams, please make sure to unmute yourself when you're called on to speak, and please identify yourself for our secretary so we can get your name straight in the record. With that, would you like to access any of the members on Teams?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, if either Clark Hopp or Brian Lindemood would care to comment on that.
Yes, through the chair, this is Brian Lindemood. For the record, Vice President, Chief Engineer, Alaska Railroad. Having been involved in that project for a very long time, I'm not familiar with any sort of legislation that would transfer lands that would be given up as that to move to somewhere else. I don't think anything got that far along.
I'll leave it be. I would like a little bit more follow-up in writing at a later date, though. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
Okay. So there are two particular projects I want to just highlight here on the rail extension, from the rail extension perspective here. And the first is the Northern Rail Extension. That was is an 80-mile project that would connect us from our terminus at current terminus at North Pole down to the Delta Junction area. This was a four-phase project kind of envisioned back in the early 2000s, that we completed the first phase, which was the longest bridge in Alaska, over the Tanana River in the Salcha area. And again, at the cost of give or take $180+ million at this point, a combination of Department of Defense funding and, in this case, actual state monies, because, again, by virtue of its economic development attributes here. There are three remaining phases to be done to bring this project to fruition, but the overarching or the overall cost at this point has, again, a little more back of the envelope. No detailed study has been done on this, but is now probably approaching the $1.7 or so billion mark. It's a tremendously expensive project. It was initially done with the idea of a kind of a multi-faceted approach. It was for the Department of Defense to provide them access not only to some of their training grounds on a year-round basis, but certainly provide connect rail down to Fort Greely in the Delta area, and then also take us a long way towards the long thought of connection to Canada point. But it's interesting that this one has, with some of the ongoing items related to truck trafficking, things of that nature, this one has kind of resurfaced of late. And there's a little bit of a resurgence of interest on this. We've certainly been in contact with the congressional delegation about this project and some touch points with the military, but still one to watch. The other rail extension that is laying a little bit fallow at the moment relates to Port McKenzie. And this is a 32-mile spur off of our main line at the Houston area down to the port, or to Port McKenzie. And this was actually a Matsu Borough project that the railroad was acting as a effectively program manager or contractor for Matsu Borough on this. A significant amount of work has been done on it. The funding for this originally was from the state to the Matsu Borough, and about $180+ million so far. The original budget on that was somewhere in the $315 to $320 million range. Now we believe that they're probably, with inflation, as time has passed, probably another incremental $190 million or so necessary to complete that project at this point and connect.
Yeah, we could just pause on that. Just curious, so as part of that project, is there the business case? So I guess the railroad would serve Point McKenzie and with the future goal of a bridge or a port there. Do you have any details on what the, if we were to look at the total program, final build out, what it would look like?
Mr. Chairman, so I think it was interesting as this project was rolling along and there was funding and it was getting closer and closer, it was interesting the amount of commercial interest that was generated in this, and with the idea of that this could be a commercially viable extension. When that stopped, when the funding stopped and the project fairly well ground to a halt, a lot of that talk, not surprisingly, kind of dried up at this point. Certainly from the railroad's perspective, we would need to be able to generate a business case to be able to provide that service down there should the capital funding be identified. At this particular point, this is far too big for something for the railroad's balance sheet to handle, especially without having identified really anchor tenants at this particular point.
All right, thank you. Let's proceed.
The fourth item on the under the strategic plan is safety. And safety, as I mentioned earlier on, is an absolute key element to running a successful railroad. So whether it's for our employees, for our customers, whether it's for the environment, other stakeholders, running a safe railroad is absolutely paramount. Really just showing here, these are our 2023 safety goals and initiatives out there. I'm not planning on going through those unless there's any specific questions to it, other than we continue to strive to have a safety culture in the organization, in the railroad, that is really reflective of who we are and what it needs to be for us traveling with, you know, 500,000 plus passengers annually, a number carrying a number of other commodities through our communities and through a very pristine wilderness. I will say that we have been working extraordinarily hard through different initiatives to, you know, really bring to make our safety, improve our safety record, improve our safety culture. This is just one metric we look at. It is a casualty rate, they call it, and it's prescribed by our regulator, the Federal Railroad Administration. Shows our 10-year of injuries, a rate per 200,000 person hours out there. And again, the trend line is moving in the right direction. You're never done with this, and we're not satisfied with this. We're going to continue to work it all there. It's something that's again of just paramount import for us.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure I understand the graph, so you're saying per 200 person hours, there's a rate of 8 incidents. Can you unpack the graph just a little bit more?
Sure. So per 200,000 hours, right? There are there are a number of incidents that are divided then by the number of person hours worked out there, and it creates creates a ratio of that, the casualty rate, again, the calculation per the regulator.
I got it. So it's 8 per 200,000.
Correct.
Over a time period. Got it. Thank you.
And you're defining reportable as requiring first aid?
Reportable is there's a specific, Chairman, there's a specific criteria laid out by the regulator as to what specifically a reportable injury is.
We have a follow-up from Senator.
And I apologize. I just like to make sure I'm capturing information correctly. So how many person hours are typical within a year? So if we're saying per 200,000, a given year is?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I'm going to phone a friend on this and ask Clark Hopp, our chief operating officer, I think I did a kind of a beastly job on explaining this.
Mr. Hopp, please put yourself on the record.
So for the record, this is Clark Hopp. I'm the chief operating officer of the Alaska Railroad. Through the chair to Senator Tobin. So an easy way to think about this would be 200,000 man hours would roughly equate to 100 employees working an entire season. And so, the last few years, we've been around 4 has been our casualty rate. So just to get your mind around that, there would be 4 reportable injuries for every 100 employees at the railroad. And yes, that is first aid. So if we have a laceration on a finger and you put a Band-Aid on it, that is a reportable injury. And then another thing that we do track at the railroad would be lost time incidents. So if you were to, say, twist your ankle and you went home for a couple of days, that would be a lost time injury. And that rate is typically about half of what this casualty rate is. So our lost time incidents are usually about that 2, in the neighborhood of 2. Does that make sense? Does that help? So, per 100 employees, there may be 2 lost time injuries a year. So overall, at the railroad last year, total casualties was around 20 lost time injuries, in the low teens. And for the record, our lost time injuries that would cause you to miss a day was at a record all-time low in 2022. So we've seen a nice reduction in the number of reportable injuries, but we've seen a much even greater reduction in the number or the severity of those injuries.
All right. Thank you. Let's proceed.
So we were asked to speak a little bit about some of the events in Ohio recently where Norfolk Southern freight train derailed and there was a chemical spill and ensuing issues out there. And to be very clear, like almost all other freight railroads, we do carry some level of hazardous materials out there. You see some of the commodities that we do carry out there. You know, what occurred in Ohio is still sort of in the preliminary phase. It appears that, you know, preliminary information is that a wheel bearing on one of the freight cars overheated and caused a derailment and therefore, you know, a spill of the chemicals out there. So it's that report. I mean, the National Transit Transportation Safety Board is on site and will be working on that, and there really won't be a definitive answer on that for most likely, or the definitive report for probably a year to 18 months. But that's what the initial outlook is on it. You know, as an industry, the rail industry is. Really, I would characterize it as extraordinarily safe with regard to movement of hazardous materials. And, I mean, I think the industry as a whole touts, you know, 99.9% of all hazardous materials arrive safely at their particular destination. I think it's the industry has also voluntarily, because it's not currently regulated, has, you know, put in a number of safeguards to ensure that with regard to usually detector-type programs and hot wheel or hot bearing detectors out there. The Alaska Railroad has a network of such detectors also. We have an entire detector network, which involves everything from hot bearing detections to some of the more newer technology of acoustic bearing detection. I mean, everything from dragging detectors, derailment detectors, wheel impact detectors out there. And to be very clear, the network that we have in place for our railroad is at shorter distances. There's a shorter distance between each of those detectors than the national average out there. This is something that we, over the years, have identified as certainly as a risk out there. Matter of fact, in 2022, we actually conducted a study, hired a contractor to come in, take a look at our network, take a look at our detection program, and relatively recently received a report on that that we're going to use to inform us to go forward as we continue to make improvements and changes to our detectors, detector program out there. But it is a... deeply unfortunate, terrible event in Ohio. It's something that, given the cargo that we carry and the passengers that we carry, again, something we take very seriously. I think there's a lot of talk at the national level about, additional regulations and additional changes that, Congress and or regulators will put in place. So we're standing by and operating, working with our national national groups on identifying the good and bad out of that at this point.
Thank you. I just have a few questions. So I guess with the relative shortness of our railroad compared to the, think of the tracks that that they have to keep track of down in the lower 48 elsewhere, that we kind of have an opportunity to be a bit of a boutique operation in that with a shorter distance we can probably over-inspected it a little bit just because of the nature of it. Is that the case, or is our somehow our what we're doing in state, is it a little bit beyond what typically happens on a given large system down in the lower 48 as far as frequency of eyes on the system?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, so as I mentioned, the average distance between our detectors is, for lack of a better term, better than what you see on average down in the lower 48 system. Some of the concerns that we have, or some of the challenges we face on this, are, of course, when you get out of the main communities in which we operate, power issues are significant for us. So, we deal with that. We use solar, we use wind, we use generators, we use all sorts of different things. Out there, but again, there are challenges with resources, and again, I think as through this detector study and other work we're doing on that, we're going to continue to try to move forward to make sure that we've got what we think is a very robust program in place, because NS found out, this can come up on you very quickly and with catastrophic results.
Right. Thank you for that. Another thing, in conversations, committee hearings with DOT, we had a great presentation where they were explaining how they were going deeper into their maintenance cycle, using data to become more predictive about failures, and so driving that improvement process to reduce the total cost of, like, bridge replacement, let's say, by a more proactive inspection regimen. And then, of course, then we heard about, you know, the leveraging effect of using drone technology to be able to fully map the underside of a bridge. And so we talked about drones earlier, but do you have any areas where you're using predictive analysis to try and determine infrastructure inspections?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So, I mean, we have very prescribed inspections for almost everything that is on the Alaska Railroad out there. But the key for us is to try, how are we going to be able to do it, effectively smarter and do it more efficiently. And, you know, one of the things where, we are subject to a what they call a transit asset management system requirements by virtue of some of the federal monies we receive. And as a result of that, it's very prescriptive about some of the maintenance activities and the inspection activities that have to occur. And that's it's one of those situations where you sometimes look at a federal regulation coming down and you say, well, this is actually a good thing for us, and that it really does help us in that. So we have a number of different systems out there that, that feed into from everything that our mechanics do, everything our maintenance personnel do, that feed into that, and then, gives us the information we need to, again, hopefully be much more predictive about identifying, weaknesses and possible failures going forward. Not saying we're there, but it's an ongoing process that we continue to, move forward with, and I think it has provided some benefit for us. We want to go deeper than that. Again, our chief operating officer is a great resource on something like this. But,
I would say if there's something you'd like to say, put yourself on the record.
Yeah. Again, for the record, this is Clark Hopp, chief operating officer, Alaska Railroad. To the chair, I have two examples. Your question regarding predictive analysis that we're pretty proud of and excited about. So in this area of hot bearing detection, because of some of our recent studies and consultant help, we just finished this past year installing what's called as a bearing acoustic monitoring. So the typical detection of hot bearings is detectors along the wayside that measure the heat on the train as it goes by. And that's a very reactive system, right? And so when temperatures reach, say, 170 degrees, you begin to get alarms, which then cause the train to stop and do a visual inspection of the bearing. Just this summer, we brought online a thing called the bearing acoustic monitoring, which is acoustic monitoring, which is predictive. So what it does, it's a listening system that's listening for things that we can't hear yet in the failure of bearing. So that's a very good predictive system, and we're one of the few small railroads that have installed that system. The big Class 1 railroads have installed it, but we're pretty proud of that technology. And then the second thing that I'm really proud of is we are probably the only short line railroad that has its own geometry car. So, a matter of fact, just this week we were running our geometry car. So this is a box car that we've equipped with state-of-the-art geometry detection equipment, which allows us to predict track flaws or track deviations before they fall out of class. So we have a certain class that we have to maintain our track structure to, and then when we inspect it physically, we finally notice it when it begins to fall out of class, and then we have to slow down speed. But this geometry car is equipped such that we run it, and it tells us before we have track that gets out of class. And we're kind of on the leading edge on small railroads of instituting that kind of technology. So those are two examples of moving towards more predictive tools as opposed to reactionary tools.
Well, thank you for that. We have a question. Senator Thiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines with the state of the track, as I recall, last great big earthquake, sloughing revealed a lot of buried old ties, buried old track, just in the soils. Wasn't maybe best practices for a rail bed today. What's our assessment? How much of that sort of problem, legacy problem, do you have to recover from and rebuild to modern standards?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, you know, that we had an amazingly strong railroad that we were down, I think, a total of 6 days in the earthquake in 2018. It did reveal some, you know, old, I wouldn't ever call them best practices, but old bad practices, right? And so for the most part, we have addressed those that we're aware of or that we saw, and that was certainly a good crucible as far as identifying some weak points of things that have been done over the last 100 years, correct? So we continue to do that. We continue to upgrade our track structure. And a lot of times those old relic processes, through some of this inspection, even a geometry part, you can begin to see them manifest themselves before they're a problem. And that's where these predictive tools become really important, as you can start to see track going out of class regularly, which would then cause you to do some investigation, saying, why is cross-level happening in this area of track? And then we can send in our engineers and geotechs and say, is this something that's naturally occurring? Is this something that we had prior poor construction techniques that have caused this? So I would never say that we've uncovered all the sins of the past, but we do have more tools available to us to identify them.
Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
And the final of the five strategic initiatives out there relates to engagement. And engagement can mean lots of different things to lots of different groups. But to us, it means really working very clearly and directly with all stakeholders. Again, whether that's customers, whether that's our neighbors, different communities out there. And we will certainly not necessarily always agree on every topic, for sure, but we will engage and we will look to find win-win solutions whenever possible. So I think we realize we are impactful throughout. We bisect a large portion of the state and run through communities, but our philosophy is to work with groups to the greatest degree possible. There are certainly times that we cannot, or we have not been able to necessarily easily come to an agreement on different things, and in recognition of that, within the last year, actually, our board of directors has created, you'll see on that second bullet on the slide, our External Issues Review Committee. And that is a group that, if effectively a stakeholder group or a group can't kind of work it out with management, it provides a vehicle to bring this to the board's attention. And it's actually a subset of the board of directors and includes also a public member on there to see if, again, a review of if management's decisions or inputs have been reasonable. So that's something that hasn't necessarily been put to great use at this particular point, but we think it's going to be a helpful vehicle to in as we continue to engage on different topics.
We could on this slide. So it, as we discussed earlier, just in preparing for the meeting, one of the biggest areas of comment whenever the railroad, I think there's two concerns. One is where the railroad isn't, where we want more railroad. And then the other is kind of the interface management around the railroad, and that's with this public engagement slide. So I guess, do you have any advice for those, let's say, you're utility company trying to, you know, whatever, lay some infrastructure in the easement needs to interface with you, or, and this is a pretty broad range of stakeholders, but you're a landowner whose property interfaces the railroad, and you have some issue, or you're a municipality and you have issues with the crossings and the maintenance of those crossings. Is there advice that you could give those stakeholders on what's the best way to engage proactively with you, and how can you engage proactively with them to improve that sense of satisfaction for the many that we've heard about? When I became transportation chair, things that I had heard before, the volume amped up, and so people are coming to me asking, you know, what can we do around that? I'm glad to see what you've got, but I would just like to dwell on this issue just a little bit more in this hearing. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I mean, from my perspective, I think using your term, proactively engage is exactly the right thing to do. I think there have been, over the years, there have been long simmering issues, perhaps, in some situations that, you know, where there hasn't been a, you know, a real open discussion between, you know, different stakeholders that may have concerns with some of which management's decisions on this. So I would encourage them, if there still are outstanding issues in their minds, to approach us and approach, you know, senior management in the railroad. If you're not getting an appropriate, you know, process or answer at the whatever level they're dealing at, I think to continue to work with the railroad is very good. What we find at times are in some situations that people, like, we haven't necessarily had what I would characterize as that discussion, and the stakeholder will look for other outlets to have those discussions with instead of actually having those with the railroad.
We have a question, Senator Wilson.
And I think being a state-based entity, I think people, some of your engagement folks, I'm going to go skip ahead here, some of your, it's like 850 active permit holders, if they have disagreement being a state entity, they may feel that they want more of a better dispute process, if you will, to be able to interact more publicly or to get a third party involved if there is a dispute in a conflict resolution process, is what we often hear. They just are just voicing a concern because, you know, we're state legislators and we can obviously legislate different items to bow shows to the railroad. But I feel, you know, and I don't not necessarily want to do that, but, you know, I think what I often hear is they just want to bring it to attention to say, hey, this is becoming a problem, but we would like some type of way to address it. We just want to be good neighbors. And we want the railroad to be a good neighbor, and how can we better foster that communication is what I often hear from various constituencies that are have to interact with the railroad.
And through the chair, Senator Wilson, very much agree with that. I think the idea of sometimes very open communication can be the best way to resolve this, and I think in the absence of that open communication, or if there is sometimes we didn't get the answer we want at one particular level in the organization, and therefore, truthfully, we're going to go to our legislator about this as opposed to continuing to have that discussion with the railroad, I think sometimes is counterproductive. And I'm not by any stretch saying that, you know, every decision we've made is, you know, perfect or in some maybe even appropriate, but I do think that having an open discussion and really us hearing at the senior management level what their concerns are and us being able to, you know, let them know for our perspective on this. And then if we can't come to a conclusion on that, well, then, you know, then elevation perhaps. But I think part of this creation of this review committee that we talked about is exactly to address something like that. So that if they don't like, after exhausting isn't the right word, but after really having that open and very direct conversation with management, if they're still dissatisfied with what the result they're receiving, then there is a vehicle to have the board, have that discussion with the board.
I, I just want to say that in my years of quality management, what one of the concepts that became aware of is voice of the customer. We've talked about it sometimes in other hearings. Is how do you drive that voice all the way deep into an organization, all the way to the point of product or service delivery, and all the way up to where key decisions are being made? And so I like seeing that this board is created. I'd like to know more about it. Maybe we can follow up as far as its public face. Do you actually have a good on-ramp for, you know, these concerns, and are they able to penetrate the normal toughening that an organization has? I mean, you got to be tough to do business, but then you also have to be able to, you know, to pull those voices in and assess what they're saying. So I'll look forward to a sidebar conversation about that as we proceed. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And starting to head towards home here, it's talk about with Senator Wilson here. We're asked also to talk a little bit about our corridor management. This is an incredibly valuable state asset. You see here, I mean, to try to recreate something like this today would be, you know, probably in the billions of dollars worth of to do this. So it's, you know, we have about 14,000 acres of right of way, and it really is primarily a safety buffer for our operating theater. But in recognition of this tremendous value, we do permit uses in the right of way, and some perpendicular crossings, some longitudinal type uses. We have a process in place, an application process for what the stakeholder or somebody else wants to do with the right of way. We do, again, in keeping with our model, we do charge a fee. It's really based on sort of a cost recovery. I mean, we're not looking to gouge people on this as an application type fee. We do use fair market value as our guide for ongoing use out there, which again is very much in concert with our model to be self-sustaining. It's, you know, certainly there have been, you know, a number of areas in this, or a number of issues within this area over the years. Again, I think we try to reach out and solve those to the extent possible.
3-minute warning.
3-minute warning. There's nothing on this slide that you haven't heard already, so I'm going to keep moving here. This is the big finish slide at this point. The Alaska Railroad is a critical infrastructure component for the state of Alaska, and a state that is really bereft of just what I would characterize as sort of basic infrastructure. It's very, very important, and therefore it's very, very important that we keep the railroad as a strong entity that can continue to go forward and serve the people of Alaska. So that's just something that we keep in mind every day as we manage the corporation going forward. And how many other entities in Alaska can actually say they are 100 years old? And that is us this year. We are celebrating our centennial on July 15th. It is going to be the block party to end all block parties in Nenana, Alaska. And hopefully you've all received your save the date invitations at this point. We'll be following up on that to see that you're here, President Harding, driving the Golden Spike. If you look very closely in the back, you'll see me. I have brown hair back in there. But it's going to be a good event. It's going to be something that we're very excited about, and we're going to really celebrate what is, I think, a very important institution for Alaska. Thank you very much for your time.
Any final questions or comments from the committee?
I just want
to. We have Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thanks for the presentation, and hopefully you didn't feel that you got railed on too hard, and just want to say thanks.
Oh, boy. We were just waiting for that one.
Tie that together.
So I want to say thank you in preparing for this hearing. We dove through a lot of the materials that you sent, and I'm a big advocate for long-term strategic plans, operating plans that are aligned with that. And as I told you in a prior conversation, I plan on using some of that as just guidance for, hey, this is what I'm talking about, because what what you presented is a good example of that that we could show for other, you know, departments, agencies that are trying to develop their plans, not overdevelop the long-term plan, keep it a framework, and then have a well-developed execution plan and the financial plan that goes along with that. So it's good information. Appreciate it. And I look forward to those follow-up discussions that we have talked about. So at exactly 3 o'clock, right on time, we'll call this committee to close. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, all of the folks that helped this happen, every committee and every day here in the Capitol. Thank you so much.